Yes, I'm trying to. I'm trying to remember. Let me think. I was driven in a car, and there was a man either side of me, and I had my hand in one of the men's jacket pockets, which sounds weird, but that was because we'd just stepped out from a police station, and I was handcuffed. I'm trying to retrieve a memory of the day I was arrested and taken to prison for stealing a credit card, which was more than 40 years ago. And as you can hear, that memory is not a single solid thing. I ended up at this strange institution. Anyway, it was called Puckle Church, and it was a prison, and I can remember that, you know, the shine on the cufflinks, the brown tweedy nature of the detective's jacket. It was like a Dun & Co type. It wasn't like Harris Tweed or Ruffman. I can remember feeling kind of excited. When we want to retrieve a memory, as I'm trying to do here, signals from our frontal cortex, some of them linguistic, link to that memory and reconstruct it from the raw information available. And the more often you access the memory, the easier it is to find. But when it comes to articulating a memory using language, things can get tricky. Dr. Julia Shaw is a psychologist best known for her work on memory and criminal psychology, where the accuracy of evidence really matters.
The way we talk about the stories of our lives has a profound impact on how those memories stay in our minds in the first place. So you're actually changing a memory every time you pull it up. And the words you use to describe what happened have a direct impact on how you're going to remember it now and how you're going to remember it later. So if you think of the original memory, right, it's this sort of almost like a cloud of sensations, of feelings, of sounds and smells. And then you have to turn that into words. So there's actually something called the verbal overshadowing effect, which says that as soon as you verbalize a memory, what your brain does is it actually sticks more to the words than these sort of fluffy concepts that they're representing. And so what you're doing is you're overwriting the original memory with your description. And from that point on, you're much more likely to remember the description, the words, rather than the actual sensations themselves.
So the link between language and memory is not always to be relied upon. Professor Steven Pinker, Harvard psychologist and cognitive scientist.
Most of what we remember does not consist of sentences in a language. When you read a passage and I take the book away, you probably would not be able to reproduce a single sentence of what you read. But if all went well, you'd be able to recount the gist of it, which suggests that most long-term memory is not stored in the format of verbal strings, but rather something more abstract, something that we call meaning or content or gist. And many experiments show that after someone reads a passage, if you then present a sentence that's synonymous with what they have seen, they will falsely claim to have read it just moments before.
And the presence of other people is key to the way we remember. Their words and their questions can corrupt the original virgin memory that we're trying to pull up. That moment when, you know, when I was in the car and someone interrupts and says, oh, yeah, was it one of those police, like, Range Rovers? And you go, no, it was before that. No, oh, you're muddying the pool, you say.
When other people ask you questions, maybe they're suggesting things to you, maybe a specific description of an emotion that you've expressed is used by your friend. You say, oh, you know, I think I was really excited when I saw this. And I go, oh, happy. And you suddenly go, oh, maybe I was happy. And so that word has replaced maybe your word, and you're just adopting another person's language into your recreation of this situation. And so you get like a year or two or 10 or 20 down the road, you might have a very, very different memory of what happened.
And to demonstrate just how real a false memory can feel, Dr. Shaw conducted an experiment in which she successfully planted false memories of breaking the law as a teenager, like me, into the minds of 60 different people.
Over the course of 3 interviews, I implanted memories of committing crime. And the purpose of the study was to show that through subtle manipulation, through using things like misinformation, so using information about their lives, so lying to them basically about an event that their parents allegedly had said had happened, by using that and using trust and using language in a way to structure their reality by asking leading and suggestive questions, that you could convince people that they had done things that never happened.
So the other event which your parents reported happening was when you were 14 years old, you initiated a physical fight and the police called your parents. You were with Ryan when it happened?
There it is. Dr. Shaw has planted her first memory. She says Your parents reported that when you were 14 years old, you initiated a fight.
If you say, you know, this happened to you, can you tell me about it? That's a leading question, combined with imagination exercises. So using words in a framework to get people to really creatively imbue the situation with details. That's the way you use words to manipulate memories. So they need to come up with the details, but you can lead them down the right path.
Remember, like, a verbal fight, and maybe I pushed or something?
Good, okay.
Maybe I pushed or something. The subject has now incorporated Dr. Shaw's untruthful suggestion that she was involved in a physical fight.
I feel like she pushed me first.
Okay.
I feel like she pushed me first, she says. Now the subject has actually embellished the false memory, cementing it even more firmly.
And then working with that, using details of their real life, so using a best friend as part of the memory, using the place that they actually lived at the time, details all that I got beforehand from the parents, and then weaving it into a narrative. And by the end, 70% of the participants falsely committed to these crimes.
It's worth remembering the context of Dr. Shaw's research, criminal psychology. This stuff matters. And 70% of her participants felt that false memory so fully that they came to believe in it as truth. Julia Shaw's work is oddly akin to Konstantin Stanislavski's method acting system, the emotion memory technique that he developed for the stage in the early 20th century, requires that an actor transfers emotion from a memory of a real event in their own lives into the experience of the fictional character that they're playing in order to convince themselves temporarily and others of the veracity of unreal circumstances. With me now is someone who has had to produce emotion on stage in a huge variety of roles, from Hamlet to Iago in Othello, Constantine in The Seagull. He is the recently knighted Simon Russell Beale. Simon, are you drawing on real memories when you create a fictional emotion on stage?
Unquestionably, there are moments when you specify a particular situation. That's Stanislavski, isn't it? But there's another thing, which I don't know whether other actors do this, but there's a sort of concentration of emotion in your body at moments of, I don't know, you're carrying Cordelia on at the end of Lear, you know, as one of the great moments of pain and
failure.
Catastrophic failure of one's own life. But what you do is you sort of concentrate misery into the centre of your body.
Do you remember your first Shakespearean speech? Was it at school? Did you do a play?
I had a wonderful headmaster at my prep school, and I'm not sure whether this is a false memory, but in my head, he asked me to read out loud the famous Dogs of War speech from Julius Caesar, and I remember sitting...
Oh, pardon me, the bleeding piece of earth.
Yes. Yeah. I remember it was a very hot day and there were big glass windows and the sun was beating through the window. So I have that sort of memory. As I say, I'm not sure whether it's true or not, but what I do remember was the thrill of it. And again, I'm not sure whether it was just being picked on to read out loud by a teacher that I admired or whether I actually got a visceral thrill out of actually reading the words.
One thing that's interesting, because there are not many people I know who have mastered language and music as well as you. I wondered whether your memorising of music uses different techniques for your memorising of speech.
Well, that's a very complicated question for me, because my early musical training was by eye, literally by looking at a score. And when somebody asks me to do a song in a show, they'll assume that I prefer to learn it around the piano with him or her banging out the notes. And I say, no, can you just give me the score? Because I do it visually. So I think for some bizarre reason, because of that training, I think my ear's been knocked out to be replaced by...
Yes.
And actually, of course, when you learn a script, very often actors will say, oh, yes, that's the line. If they're being totally honest, that's the line at the bottom of page 43.
I can see
it. And that's before the turn.
Music, emotion, and memory have deep connections in our brains, which go back to our very earliest development.
Six brown cows walk down to drink. Flash goes the first as he comes to the brink.
This is where our memory for language first begins. The unborn baby hears the tones and rhythms of the mother's voice, and a memory of that music is embedded within its rapidly growing brain. And so a few months later, we emerge already with an innate ability to recognize and remember the melodic patterns of our native language. Usha Goswami is director of the Center for Neuroscience in Education at the University of Cambridge.
So the infant does hear through fluid the modulations of the mother's voice. So it's like hearing someone talking underwater in a swimming pool. You know that they're saying something and you can hear the speech rhythm, but you don't really know what the words are. But we know that infants learn in the womb their mother's voice. And so as soon as they're born, if you offer them a choice of listening to, say, their mother's voice reading a story or an unfamiliar mother reading the same story, they'll choose to listen to the mother's voice.
And if our memory naturally favours a parental timbre, it follows that our earliest memories of language will be associated with those words spoken to us by our parent or primary carer. So I have very strong memories of my mother's voice reading to me, reading A.A. Milne poetry, for example. The one that I always used to almost sob and bounce up and down like a big red India rubber ball was King John's Christmas. King John was not a good man, and all he wanted in life was a big red India rubber ball. Stephen Pinker, although from Canada, not from Britain, he also has memories of A.A. Milne being read.
Let's see. James Morrison Morrison, Weatherby George Dupree, took good care of his mother, though he was only three. I remember some of the early Dr. Seuss stories. I also remember the pleasure of complicated words that Dr. Seuss deliberately put into these very simple children's stories just to give them the delight of sounding them out. I can read long words too, like Constantinople and Timbuktu. That, I think, is from One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish. And I probably read that at the age of four, and that's how I learned the words Constantinople and Timbuktu. And it was a special pleasure as a 4 or 5 year old sounding out those long words.
What's key in the case of those A.A. Milne poems, I think, is that the words that scan and rhyme are the memorable ones in adult life as well as childhood. James, Morrison, Morrison, Weatherby, George Dupree, as Stephen says. You know, it's just like I sprang to the stirrup and Joris and he, I galloped, galloped, we galloped all three. You know, the Robert Browning, How I Brought the Good News, etc. And poetry's primary purpose thousands of years ago was to be a storage system before writing even. But it's not only rhythm that makes speech memorable. Imagine you're on a beach with the sound of the waves lapping at your toes. Feel the way they wash through your mind and your body.
So for a long time, speech science was really focused on the fact that we have these pitch changes when we speak. You know, your voice will be higher or lower in pitch, and the brain certainly cares about that. But there are also changes in intensity in the sound waves that we produce. And those changes in energy or intensity turn out to have structure in and of themselves. So you can think of a sound wave coming to your brain as someone speaking to you in a sort of overall envelope of sound, like a sort of 3D wave. But then you can think that just like when a wave breaks on the beach, there are different eddies and currents within that overall breaking wave. The same is true of the sound wave of speech. And it turns out that those little eddies and currents actually have intrinsic structure that's fairly reliable across speakers, particularly if you're speaking deliberately to a rhythm where the stressed syllables are, is roughly occurring twice a second across most human languages. So it's a sort of template that's language universal. So a lot of things we do with young children, like nursery rhyme play, is deliberately rhythmic. And this turns out to amplify this structure that's inherent in the sound wave and help the brain to learn these statistical patterns.
So the more children can play among the waves, the rhythms, the rhymes and the music inherent in spoken language, the more they're developing memory. And this process chugs along nicely and quietly in the background without conscious effort, building as we grow older. You remember the pellet with the poisons in the vessel with the pestle, or was it something to do with the flagon with the dragon?
We want
or
the chalice from the palace.
No, I don't want the vessel with the pestle. I want the chalice from the what?
The chalice from the palace. Hmm? It's a little crystal chalice with the figure of a palace.
Does the chalice from the palace have the pellet with the poison?
No, the late great Danny Kaye in the 1956 comedy masterpiece The Court Jester, directed by Melvin Frank and Norman Panamar, as I remember, enacting the fear of not quite remembering, despite the rhythmic pattern which conforms to Usher's two stressed syllables a second formula. Danny Kaye has to retrieve that memory in order to poison his opponent before a joust. And we face moments just like this, possibly with a little less jousting and only a tiny bit of poison, when we need robust memory in an exam, on stage. It's critical that we retrieve the words we need for the occasion. For Swedish-Mongolian triple world record-holding memory athlete Yenja Wintersoul, retrieval is her USP. And here's Yenja on the American TV show Pickler and Ben in 2017, memorising the names of 20 audience members she has never met before in under a minute.
Susan?
A ring of the bell signals a correct memory.
Debbie? Carla? And Linda?
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it was a lot of just trying to associate, okay, this woman is called Rose, so I have to memorize and kind of imagine roses on her head or something rosy about her personality. But to do that for, like, hundreds of people, it does take training.
The word association techniques Yenja and fellow memory gymnasts use to embed words and images very quickly in their minds for the short term is called mnemonics, from the Greek word mnemon, meaning to remember. And the ancient Greeks distinguished between two types of memory, the natural memory and the artificial memory. The former is innate and instinctive. The latter has to be trained and developed using these techniques.
Memory techniques are a little bit like training wheels, you know, when you're a kid and you're first learning how to ride a bike. So in the same way, when you use memory techniques, you kind of memorize words using the techniques, and then eventually the idea is that you don't need to use that anymore. So for example, say somebody wants to learn Mongolian, and I'm teaching them a word like table. Table in Mongolian is shire. And then I would try to ask the person what language they are most familiar with. And let's say they speak English as a first language. Then I would try to associate that with a shirt, for example. So shire, shirt, sounds very approximate. And so I asked them to memorize a table just made out of shirts. And so this kind of abstract and bizarre visual imagery is easier for the brain to remember than just a six-letter word like shire. Obviously, every time they say table in Mongolian, I hope that they don't have to think about a shirt in English, but eventually that kind of goes away and you just use the word so much that it becomes contextual.
Most mnemonic techniques are exercising short-term memory, which is rather like the brain's post-it note. Professor Steven Pinker.
Short-term memory has, at least as one of its components, a linguistic representation. That is, we almost go through the motions of articulating a string of words, a snatch of sound, and then that gets translated into a kind of auditory image. We almost hear ourselves saying that stretch of language. We repeat that in a loop, and that can keep material active in memory over a span of seconds, allowing us to perform cognitive operations on that material.
One of the toughest cognitive operations Yenja Wintersoul has undertaken took her into the labyrinthine language of a certain Swedish interiors store. She has memorized the entire IKEA catalogue.
And that took a week and a lot of crying. No, I was watching a lot of Game of Thrones, and then I would memorize it and then watch a lot of Game of Thrones and then memorize it. And that was 328 pages. And not only was it a visual task, it was very language related because I had to remember all these Swedish words for the products, like remembering that on page 84, there's a couch and it's called klippan, which means cliff in Swedish. And that's how I memorized it. And kind of knowing how to explain everything to like crowds of millions was kind of hard, too. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Yenja, IKEA's human catalog.
Can you describe what you see?
On the Hemnes bookcase, on the top, there's like a trumpet, then a little sculpture.
There's a girl with no front teeth.
Is she on 254 and she's cooking?
Bad enough trying to remember why exactly you came into the store in the first place. In fact, though, IKEA's curious product names, like Hemnes, which we heard there, conform to a strict internal logic devised by the store's founder, Ingvar Kamprad. He struggled with dyslexia and had trouble remembering conventional item codes like mattress 325A, for example, and so he invented his own taxonomy, his own system. Rugs are named after Swedish cities or towns, while bedsheets and pillowcases are named after flowers and plants. The associations evoked through these names gave Ingvar the retrieval cues he needed to know whether Idealisk is a bookcase or a corkscrew. It's a corkscrew, of course. So Simon Russell Beale with me in the studio here. Drawing on material over the long term, are you good at that? Your first Shakespearean role, what was that? It was a female role, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, my first triumph was Desdemona at my senior school. Yes, and of course I was cast because of the singing.
Yes.
Because I'd had this training as a singer as a child. And I think the head of English said, we need somebody who can sing the Willow song. I wasn't cast for my beauty.
Simon. And can you remember her lines?
No, I can't. But it's interesting, later I did King Lear when I was 17 or whatever. And 40 years later, when I do it at the National Theatre, I opened that first to start learning it and I knew it. And I thought somewhere in my brain, Lear has been sitting, waiting to
on
be...
On the floor of the attic, as it were, in a much simpler sense in the role that memory has to play in performance and acting. How do you remember all those lines? I've had that. And when people have nothing nice to say about a performance, they go, I'm so impressed by your line learning.
It is the mystery, actually. And I'm 58 now, and it's just getting a little bit slower.
When you're young, the act of rehearsing, just simply the act of saying it a few times, it's long.
And I used to just learn it the night before.
Yeah.
In the pub.
Yes.
With a couple of pints of beer, and I used to learn the next day's scenes, and they'd stick.
I've heard it said that what you learn just before you go to sleep. Lodges.
And I've done that trick, and it does work.
Yes, it does.
It does work. I mean, I think mine is a slog of argument, really. You know, if I say this, then I'll have to say that, because that's the only logical thing I can say. Every weather leaven tods. I remember that was the first line of The Young Shepherd at Winter's Tale in the second half, in the fourth act. And I remember I never forgot Every Weather Leaven Tods because it took me so long to learn. But I think that sort of sequence of logic is the only way I can describe it. I did Candide for the National Bernstein Musical. Mm. And the trouble about music is it doesn't stop.
No.
So there's no time to, if you
gather
dry,
your thoughts,
to gather your thoughts. And I was doing a solo number with a chorus, and I did a verse, and then I did a chorus, and the chorus would repeat. And I dried, and the course of music was still going on. I couldn't remember what the words were, so I did the whole chorus as la 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 la, so just la la. And then the chorus, bless them, had to repeat it, all of them.
So they did la la
la la la la la la. It went on for what felt like hours.
Like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning. On an ever-spinning reel.
So, yes, those tip-of-the-tongue moments in Korea, they call it the sparkle at the end of the tongue. It's as if there's a physical sensation when a word is stuck there, but you just can't find the sound of it.
Like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind.
It's so familiar to memory psychologists that they just call it TOT, tip of the tongue. It's related to a phenomenon called feeling of knowing, FK, where you know you know the answer, but you can't actually come up with the answer. And it suggests that memory is not a unified whole, that any memory consists of different components, and that you might have access to some of those components while other components are not retrievable, even though they are present. And so a lot of memory consists of providing the links that allow you to access it on demand.
So when it comes to learning and remembering a second language, it's actually our ability to store and retrieve words in our own language which can show whether we'll be successful. And that's how Dr. Andreu Reivas measures people's ability to learn a new language. Although Dr. Reivas uses the most peculiar words to do this.
Defermication. Plisterelection. Stopographic and defermication. Good.
Dr. Reivas is an expert in second language acquisition at University College London. She's working through a series of non-words which sound like English words. Defermication doesn't exist, but it sounds like an English word, doesn't it? As an English speaker, it's my ability to remember these made-up English words which will tell her how efficient my short-term phonological memory is, and therefore how successful I'll be at learning and remembering, say, Hungarian or perhaps Danish.
when people do this test, they need to listen to words that do not exist in English, but they sound as English words. They follow exactly the same phonotactic rules. These are the rules of phonology in a particular language. So usually we start with two-syllable words, then a three-syllable word would be penifer, then a four-syllable word could be something like peniferal, and a five-syllable word could be something like deformication.
As children, we learn and remember a first language with ease because, well, we're learning implicitly through everyday use, consolidated with playing and singing and hearing stories and cues from our parents. But as adults, we have to learn and store new languages explicitly before they can become implicit.
But the more advanced we get, the more we know about the second language, the more confident speakers we are, much of our knowledge can become implicit. For example, in my case, now I teach in English, some of my knowledge about English as a second language is still explicit, but much of it has to be implicit because now I'm talking to you, I'm not really thinking about how I'm using the language. So part of my knowledge must be stored in implicit memory.
And take note, monoglots, people like Andrea, who speak more than one language, and globally speaking, they are in the majority, have a lower risk of developing memory problems like Alzheimer's disease later on. The defining cognitive feature of the disease is explicit memory failure. But if your explicit memory has been well exercised over a lifetime by learning a language or even writing a memoir or performing Hamlet, then overall, your memory is statistically much less likely to fail later. So here's a new word for you to learn, opsimath, one who learns late in life, and it's never too late. Some memories, for certain words, though, will probably stay with us forever.
The things you learn earliest, so the earliest acquired words, tend to be the most robust because, in a way, they're the ones your brain has practiced most. When we used to learn poems by heart in school at the age of 5 and 6, those kind of experiences, they're very often refreshed, and so they're much stronger. And so if you start losing your access to language in later life, perhaps because you have a semantic dementia or another kind of illness, you typically retain access to those early encoded linguistic routines for longer, and then you just need the right retrieval cue to trigger that routine being produced.
In a care home for the elderly, where many people are suffering from memory loss, local children visit to sing songs and nursery rhymes. And guess what? Everyone remembers the words. Here we go, swish, and your wheels go round. Giddy up, we're